Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. When did cheap plastic disposables with 90s-style graffiti art become the norm? No offense if gaudy pastel is your style, but the Flonk Max Smart embodies a smarter way to vape. The Flonk is sleek and discreet, and the most popular flavors are available nicotine-free and in 2% and 5% strength. A flexible disposable with a smart LED screen, the Flonk churns out 10,000 dense and delicious puffs. Visit MyPod.com and use promo code STOOL for 25% off Flonk vapes.
Reveille, reveille, reveille!
One time, he brushed dirt away with his foot and blew him into 1,000 pieces. And the whole time, me and these three Marines are picking up pieces of him for a couple of hours, right? Up until we got to the upper half of him, which was he'd been almost cut in half, completely eviscerated, and picking up pieces of him. All I thought about the whole time was, did we practice how to do this enough?
Welcome back to another edition of Zero Block 30. Today we only have one round in the magazine, and that's my interview with the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. I went to his house, got to hang out there. It was incredible. As soon as I got in the room, I was a little bit nervous, a lot nervous. And I'm sure everybody could see it. I was nervous to the point, honestly, when I was putting together all the different equipment, the camera equipment, the sound. I did all that by myself. So if it's shitty, it's because I did it myself, and it's awesome. Congratulations to me because I did it all myself. And you could be awake all day by yourself with your pals, whatever, but you need to do it with our friends at Proper Wild. It's a clean all-day energy shot designed to boost your energy, focus, productivity without the jitters or that crash. There's no preservatives, no artificial sweeteners, no chemicals, just a natural-tasting energy shot with clean ingredients that work. Try their newest flavors, strawberry, kiwi, apple, and lemon lime. I'm a huge kiwi strawberry guy. Anytime I can get a strawberry kiwi, buddy, I absolutely do it. If we're going to the beach, I might even make me a little kiwi strawberry sandy. I might make a sandwich right there, right in everybody's faces. But I usually don't like the strawberry kiwi in a drink. Why? Because it tastes gross. It tastes like you're drinking nothing but syrup and artificial flavoring. And like I said before, there is none of those artificial sweeteners, horrible chemicals, or preservatives in this bad boy. If you want to try it yourself, go to properwild.com/barstool to get the Proper Wild at 30% off. Again, go to properwild.com/barstool to try it out. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. Get to know yourself can be a long process, especially when we're talking about growing and changing. I've changed so much since I got out of the Marine Corps. You're probably hearing that now with this interview with the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. Change is a part of life. I was really into being a Marine. Then I got out. I had to find some therapy, and I found that through BetterHelp, because therapy is all about deepening your self-awareness and understanding, because sometimes we don't know what we want or we act the way that we do until we talk things through. BetterHelp connects you with a licensed therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery wherever you are. I have, during COVID times, I went to my therapist. They weren't offering any type of virtual stuff. I had to switch over. And thank God I had the ad reads for BetterHelp. Now I use it. My wife uses it. Even my little kid uses it. And we all like it. It's easy. If you don't like your therapist, you could switch. There's no stigma. There's none of that stuff. If you're super busy, like not really me, but like my wife, you have the time to go to BetterHelp because you don't have to drive there. You could do it through voice talk. You could do it through video conferencing. There's all kinds of different ways that you can do it. And if you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/zero to get 10% off your first month. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/zero.
I am here with Sergeant Major Troy Black. And when we start out, I want to tell you, we've met before. And I didn't tell you before we started recording, but when you were the Sergeant Major of OCS, there was a Master Sergeant that you knew from the drill field that worked at the advanced school for the Sergeant.
Yeah, Leger.
Yes. And she brought me to your office. There was a Marine that I had that was going through Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I asked you, what should I do? And you told me, Sergeant Major, or Sergeant, your job is not to worry about what the policy is. Your job is to take care of your Marines. And it changed my leadership approach. And I wanted to thank you for that. Like, he does amazing things now. And I think a lot of that is because people stood by him and people like you gave great advice. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. I don't remember that specific case, but it would be, well, it's all about people, right?
Yes, sir, Major.
I think sometimes, and we'll get into some great questions, I'm sure, but you kind of got to bifurcate your mind a little bit, right? You're either this or you're that,
right?
We're both, right? But when you're in this uniform, which is a lifestyle, you answer to this, and that takes some fortitude sometimes, right?
Yes, sir, Major.
It's all about people. It's all about people.
It is. And you began this process a while ago. You've been in the Marine Corps for quite a while. You don't stay in this house. You're the first Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps to ever stay in this house. And it's the history is awesome. And I'll be honest with our listeners, it's the first time I've been nervous in a long time. Because, I mean, you still have that, and you said it with the Commandant before we started working. You still have that Lance Corporal brain, the PFC brain. Yeah. I remember the first time I saw General Hagee, and I thought he was like a god that walked on water. And then Sergeant Major Estrada walked in, and I was like, no, that's the guy that walks on water. And it was being a junior Marine and sitting here with the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, it's still something that is odd to me that I'm doing this. And if you told me when I was a Lance Corporal, I'd be like, no way that I would be doing that. But I want to start off when you were a Lance Corporal and you were a Corporal. When you were at that rank, did you ever see or did you ever dream of being in this role?
Well, it wouldn't have mattered if I had dreams or not. If you knew Lance Corporal Black, there'd be absolutely no way that this would ever have happened, right? I know for a fact. In fact, there's I call him a good friend of mine. He works down at MARSOC right now, retired Marine. And I've engaged with him several times, kind of visiting him through there. And he wrote me a non-recommendation. He was my COG, my Corporal of the Guard when I was on sea duty. He wrote me a non-recommendation for promotion to corporal from a lack of maturity and a lack of tact. I'm not sure if I still have a lack of maturity, maybe a little lack of tact still. But I would say as Lance Corporal Black, when I've had a vision of being a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. Yeah, because we all want to be the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, right?
Right.
But there's, you know, been a million people that have worn a uniform since then. I think that's almost a literal statement at this point.
Right.
There's only one that ended up being the 19th Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. It fascinates me every single day, to be quite frank with you. And I tell senior enlisted in particular all the time. It's not an accident that you are where you are. But there's a lot of luck involved in it.
Oh, big time.
Right. There's a lot of chance involved in that. Because I think the pool of individuals who can serve at these senior levels is deep. We shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking like there's only one or there's only five or six or whatever that, or even if it's general or flag officers, right? There's more that are out there. But being that one, it's tremendous. My wife, who we'll talk about in a moment, is a retired first sergeant. And every day, you can hear them out right now. Outside, behind you is the parade deck that the Friday night parades take place on. And we sit here sometimes listening to the band play or we see the Marines drilling and we go, can you believe? I mean, can you believe this is where we are?
Right. And
it's amazing.
I think when Marines look at somebody in your position and really the higher echelon of leaders in the Marine Corps, everybody views you as very stoic all the time and that it's constantly... You eat, sleep, breathe the Marine Corps. And there is aspects about that. But I remember finding out that I was going to be promoted to Staff Sergeant. And all my Marines thought that I was very stoic as well. And I had that personality. In fact, with this job, I've had several Marines that reached out and were like, we had no idea you were funny and now you work in comedy. But when that list came out, I was fist pumping. I was doing all that. When you get the call to be the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, what's your first reaction?
I've told this story a number of times, but there's a process by which the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps is selected. And it's not maybe worth talking about that process here, but in the day, it gets down to, you know, like the phone call, right? And so I get a phone call from our commandant, General Berger, and he says, hey, you know, he's a very humble, courteous individual. Rather than say, you're going to be, he's like, hey, what would you think about being the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps?
No, I don't want to.
Yeah, and it's kind of like my joke, right? That's like my spin is like, and so I thought about it, you know, I considered it for like 4.5 milliseconds, but it seemed like thousands of years, right? And I was like, hell yeah. You know, so I mean, that's kind of how you respond to it. What are you going to say? But it's interesting. It's interesting because he, of course, I engaged with General Berger and Sergeant Major Green, our previous Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. No jokes aside, if you're a color, you got pretty good, if your name's a color, you got pretty good chance of being a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. Joking. But he says, sit back and think for a minute. Right? You've said yes to the comment, like I would say a no. Now he says, take a step back and think about it. And think about what it is that you're about to step off into. You got promoted to Staff Sergeant. It's the exact same feeling.
Okay.
It's the exact same feeling. It was the exact same feeling you had going from Lance Corporal to Corporal. Except then you're kind of like, yeah, I can still play in the middle of the road a little bit, right?
Right.
I don't have to be super stoked. I'm an NCO. Mm-hmm. My buddy's right here. I got a good story about that if you want to mention about what it means to be an NCO.
I do.
But corporal to sergeant. Sergeant to staff sergeant.
Big.
You're like, holy smokes, I have made it.
People treat you with, everybody treats you with respect.
Yeah. And you mentioned being stoic. Well, stoic might just be being mature. You can't tell the same jokes the same way anymore because now you're someone who's passed like your promotion warrant, like to be emulated. Now you're like, must strive constantly for perfection. Wrap that up in the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
That was in testimony last week, testimony of preparation. Our legislative affairs does a practice with us before we step off into testimony. One of the observers is like, Sergeant Major, you're so stoic. I said, I'm sitting here practicing to go stand in front of the House Armed Services Committee. Are you kidding me? What am I supposed to do? Kick back? You know, hey, I got a question for you, man. You can't do that.
Right.
There's responsibilities that come with the bill. And that's what Sergeant Major Green was trying to tell me. He goes, you're still Troy Black. You're still Sergeant Major Black. There's a little bit of Lance Corporal Sergeant, a little bit of you in there. But it's how you present it. And it's the weight of responsibility that's on your shoulders that you don't fully appreciate till about 6 months in. And everybody's clapping, everybody's going, yay, congratulations, and you send your first tweet out. You know, you get like 5 comments in, you find out that the world doesn't really like you.
Right.
Right? So, yeah, it's every day.
And it's not like for your drill instructor. When you're a drill instructor, you go in, you're a green belt, you're able to talk to the senior drill instructor. There's plenty of people that have been in that same role that you're going into. Plenty of people are regimental drill masters. Plenty of people have been the sergeant major of a battalion. There's not many that's been the sergeant major of the Marine Corps. So your pool for advice is very small. How is that community, you guys talking to each other, knowing the ins and outs and really understand what the other one's going through?
Well, I mean, I think it's, although small, unique. It's probably not like any other occupation that you would get into for the first time, right? I'm sure you've got mentors that have helped you be successful at this enterprise, right? And they reached out to you. Do this, don't do that. Think about this, don't think about that. Are you going to produce videos with cursing in it? Or are you going to make funny jokes?
I'm going to do cursing, yeah.
Right? But you're making these decisions, right? They give you advice. Every surviving Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps reached out to me early on and gave me lots of advice. And it was all good advice. Most interestingly, they all said almost the exact same thing. Remember, their experiences at a different time. There's different things going on in society. There's either combat or conflict or war going on while they're sitting, you know, in their seats with their commandants who are all different. The Department of Defense, everything is different, right? But they all were pretty consistent. focus on Marines, focus on their families. You can't get it wrong. And if you ever need help, pick up the phone and call.
Yeah, I think that that is what I would try to do as a leader of that magnitude. I imagine the pressure of walking around and essentially having to have everything squared away, because Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps walks into a room and your uniform even is a little bit off. Everything has to be perfect. That pressure, do you feel that pressure on a daily basis?
Yeah. If I was being honest about it, I pressed out my MARPAC this morning because I was going to be on camera.
Okay.
Has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, for the first probably half of my career, we still did that, right?
Right.
So it's part of who I am as a Marine. But absolutely. I know someone's going to watch this and somebody's going to have like a digital measuring device. It's going to put the two tips of the ends of my chevron and say, oh, it's 15 16th. It's not, you know, it's going to be some random like, yeah, he's not perfect. Yeah, okay. But I think there's also a bit of solace in knowing that there isn't anybody that's perfect.
No, there's not. And even the Marine Corps as a whole, moving forward and advancing and how we're going to be better. A lot of stories that are in the news right now, they talk about Russia, they talk about China and the threats that are there. And they are very real threats. The thing that bothers me as a Marine is when people start talking down or they question the lethality of the Marine Corps. Is the Marine Corps as lethal as it was?
Yes.
Is it more lethal than it's ever been?
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit of the thought process that went into the sniper decision? We have a lot of people that are wondering. I had an Instagram post, what would you like me to ask the Sergeant Major? And one of the top questions is, why did we get rid of tanks and why did we get rid of the sniper program and how does that help our lethality?
What's a good way to explain? Without being flippant, I'm certain at one point in time, the flintlock was a very impressive weapon, right? There was training, there was doctrine, there was ways to employ it. There were formations that were designed to maximize the effects of the flintlock. And then somebody said, hey, we got this rifle thing, right? It's going to increase your range, it's going to be more accurate. It may take a little more time. You got to retrain everybody. You got to think differently about how you would engage. Frontal assaults maybe not be so good with this thing. Distance is closing, not so good, right? Because it's a longer range, it's more accurate. And there's probably a lot of resistance to that.
There is. And we've gotten, and I think that that's part of being a higher level leader is that you can listen to the feedback of the Marines on the ground. And obviously that's very important, but knowing when to draw that line of what they want, what they know and what's good for the future. How is coming to that grips with that in this position?
I think it's challenging, but time is a good teacher. You know, I think, remember we talked earlier about, we talk social media in a minute, I'm pretty sure that's how we engage nowadays, right? But at the end of the day, if you just take a step back and think, here's an example. I joined the Marine Corps in 1988. The Soviet Union is still a thing.
I was going to say it, but I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
88 was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
I was six.
But it's relevant, right?
Yeah, it is.
The Soviet Union was still a thing. In my memory, there wasn't a discussion on the fall of the Soviet Union in 1988.
Right.
Right. And I have a couple of personal experiences that are indicator of that. But at the end of the day, nobody knew that within 3 years, there would no longer be a Soviet Union. Right. So the entire force is operating in the Cold War. What's interesting is you said you were six then. It's about 1982 that our doctrine in the United States shifted from attrition warfare, high-end conflict, my term, not the one used then, to low-intensity conflict and military operations other than war, almost a decade before the fall of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
And so, so then General Gray becomes a commandant. He starts talking about, we're no longer a Marine amphibious force. We're a Marine expeditionary force. Mm. We're going to do things like mount or enhanced mount. We're going to operate in, lo and behold, the desert. Well, what happened when we went to Desert Storm, right? We're going to do different things differently. And set the entire Marine Corps up for how we operated, trained, and conducted our business in the 1990s. All with the vision that we weren't going to do Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal, large amphibious force operations like we had once done. The times had changed. No one knew the Soviet Union was going to fall. It took until 2001. But that decade of preparing for that, right, that's pretty interesting. So your conversation about concepts. Let's reverse that. The violent extremists exist. They're going to continue to exist. Mm-hmm. China is our enemy. Russia is our adversary. Iran, North Korea, violent extremism, right? Those are the
Al-Shabaab.
Yeah, Al-Shabaab. Those are all our national defense strategy has us focused on. The last three administrations have focused on the Pacific for a reason. As someone who spent almost those entire two decades, right, fighting in the Middle East or violent extremism around the globe, that's a very valued experience. But that's not going to win against a peer. So this evolution of things, we have to have understand that our senior leaders aren't foolish.
Right.
They are visionary. That's why they are who they are. And our national defense strategy is focused on somewhere. So here's the thing. The Taliban doesn't have long-range precision strike missiles.
Mm-hmm. A lot of our other enemies do, and they're nuclear.
Yeah. I have seen success on the battlefield against Baathist extremists. I have yet to have one challenge air dominance or air superiority.
Right.
Right. I don't know the full naval capabilities of Al-Shabaab. Right. But I know we have a United States Navy, and I know that we have an adversary building a Navy at the rapid rate and one who used to compete against globally that still has a relevant naval force. This is a different way of thinking about warfare. Warfare. And I think as we see ourselves, the entire joint force, by the way, is modernizing. It's not just the Marine Corps. It is in typical Marine Corps fashion, however, we picked up our pack and we were running faster than everybody else
right.
because we can do that. But this idea that we're modernizing the force for a mission that we don't think we're going to have, I would just take a step back. I would take a step back and think about who the adversary really, really is right now.
And how does that look? Because training battalions have looked the same for a long time after going to Iraq and Afghanistan and being primary doing what you're talking about. How do we change? Is it going to be slow or is it going to be a quick change to focus more on the amphibious side?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. I've got several MUs under my belt, even while I've been involved in the wars on terror. I did a MU back in 05 and ended up going into Iraq. And I did one again in 14. We actually supported part of the fight against ISIS at the time. And so the amphibious capability of the Marine Corps has been there. We might be a little rusty on it because it hasn't been the primary focus as we've been focused on these land battles or on the ground inside the desert in the Middle East. But the fact of the matter is our root existence is amphibious operations. Call them littoral operations. Not a new phrase. We've been talking about what percentage of the planet lives within the littorals, as a geography major might say to call it, instead of littorals, since you came in the Marine Corps.
Right.
It's not a new thing, right? But we didn't operate within those littorals for that amount of time because we were focused on what our nation called us to do. Now we're kind of back there because our adversary is a maritime nation, by the way, right? The primary one. The other one's landlocked. We can talk about how that's going in a moment. But how do you compete in that environment now? How do you compete now? Sea lines of communication are now important things again. They weren't maybe previously, or we weren't as focused on them. What's the Marine Corps mission in that? The seizure of advanced naval bases is part of the Marine Corps mission. What does that mean? Does it mean the same thing it used to? Or does it mean the same thing, but with different capabilities, right? I would argue it's the latter, not the former. Great case in point. Last week, 2 weeks ago, actually, the Commandant and I were in 29 Palms, and we were at the ITX, really the MWX, and that's where the ITX has changed a little bit too, but the MWX is the ending portion now where you take the two C2 nodes, in this case, the 3rd MLR, Marine Littoral Regiment, and 7th Marine Regiment, and they're out in the battle space, and they're competing against each other. The MLR did extremely well against the all-powerful 7th Marine Regiment, which also did phenomenally well. But what didn't happen is the straight-leg reinforced infantry regiment did not completely steamroll in a matter of moments, you know, this Marine Littoral Regiment, which has a whole different level of capabilities, right? That didn't occur. Interesting when you think about it from an all-domain perspective.
It really is, and how much things have changed just since you have joined the Marine Corps. Even Desert Storm, you were involved with that. That answer that you just gave to the previous question is very much a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps question, knowing different battlefields, knowing different theaters, and how those intertwine. I want to hear some stories from Desert Storm that you did not, that you weren't the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, that shows the junior side of you.
Yeah. although it seems like a long time ago, I think Marines, Marines have this like instant memory, right? You remember a lot more about being in the Marine Corps across your career than some people would give your memory credit for. Man, Desert Storm. First of all, I showed up late to the fight. I checked in from sea duty. I was on the USS Forrestal when we still had sea duty as my first tour of duty. Interestingly enough, we were talking about the Soviet Union a moment ago. There was a summit between then President Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev in the Mediterranean in Malta. President Bush came aboard our aircraft carrier right after that summit, which essentially was the last time the Soviet Union was like a thing. It was interesting how history has a habit of working out. Anyways, when I checked into the 1st Marine Division after sea duty, I watched the 5th MEB like literally leave. The day I checked in, the 5th MEB was heading towards the Middle East, 5th Marine Expeditionary Brigade. I caught up with them in Oman doing a FANC, which is kind of a big deal nowadays, as we kind of were landing in Oman, and that kind of drew away some of the forces out of Kuwait and Kuwait City from Iraq's perspective. And then I ended up landing with the battalion, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, my first infantry battalion, my alma mater, as it were, into Kuwait, and then working our way up through Kuwait. because I was the boot, right, I had the pleasure of living on top of an Amtrak for like the whole entire time, which is interesting because I was a machine gunner. We had this thing called Air Watch at the time. So you literally had I had an M60 machine gun, and my job, along with another machine gunner who was also a new Marine. I wasn't a new Marine.
See, that phrase that you just said blew my global war on terrorism brain.
What's that?
Air Watch. Like being a 50 cal gunner looking in the air. Because everything that we've done, you're looking down roads, you're looking behind canals, you're looking behind palm trees in Fallujah, you're doing whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
The last thing you're doing is looking at anything in the sky. You were never worried about it, unless it was mortars or something like that.
But in Desert Storm, the fourth largest military on the planet was in Iraq. The fourth largest military on the planet was Iraq. So you were worried about like their helicopters. You were worried about their jets. Now, I'm not sure what the hell I was going to do with an M60 against a fast mover, but that was a tactic that was like real. And so I'm on top of an Amtrak, you know, for a couple of weeks, driving through the desert. You've seen the pictures of all the, you know, the oil in the sky. You know, there's oil raining down on us. I've got a set of chocolate chip camis that are at my grandmother's house. They have oil spots all over them, you know, and I'm just looking for aircraft to be flying around randomly and shoot my M60 at them in case, you know, they came buzzing by.
And I that's why I think Jarhead is one of the best stories. That's one of the reasons why I joined, because of the way that Marines act with each other. One thing that I've noticed, and not being in units, obviously, and not being in platoons anymore, it seems like the Marines have changed a little bit since I left. And we hear that phrase a lot. How do you feel the Marine Corps has changed since you joined and to now?
I put a Sergeant Major Increment memo out on this maybe a year or so ago. And it talks about the difference in generations, right? I don't think there's any difference. I think the people change. I think there's some generational differences. I think maybe education society has some differences. But if we really think about this for a moment, I'll use myself as an example. That Lance Corporal on top of that Amtrak with an M60 had a first sergeant who was a Vietnam veteran. And he, like his generation of Marines, was convinced, like most of my instructors at ITB were, that the Marine Corps was going to fail miserably. If we ever got into combat again, we were all going to die, because our generation of Pepsi drinking, popping your collar yuppies from the 1980s were going to lose, because we didn't have any, we had no determination. We were weak. We weren't smart. And we were just a bunch of spoiled kids.
Mm-hmm. With their color TVs. And
yeah. Like you guys had telephones and you had cable TV. You're going to. You know, you're crap. If you fast forward 30 years, I'm pretty certain, like, that's the same perception. And here's a great example. I ask, I go see an NCO academy, or I'm in a group of NCOs, especially sergeants. Gotta love our sergeants. Hey, what are Marines like today compared to when you came in? And the reaction is the same every time. Oh, Sergeant Major.
Yeah.
I mean, Marines nowadays are so much different. I'm thinking to myself, when did you come to the Marine Corps? Like, well, 5 years ago. So way back in 17.
Right? Yeah.
Way back in like 18 or 17. I mean, I've almost been a Sergeant Major in the Marine Corps as long as you've been in the Marine Corps. But you think that Marines nowadays aren't as good as when you came back, when you came in, right? So I think it's a matter of perspective. I am absolutely certain that today's Marines are going to, at minimum, be at least as good as us. Probably safe to say they're better in the ways we need them to be better. So I don't get into this generational thing. Otherwise, the 20 years I spent fighting around the Middle East and my generation of Marines, my generation of Marines, apparently we all failed because some dudes told us that 15, 20 years before that, we were not going to be any good.
And you're getting close to the end of your time as Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. When you pass off, what would be the thing that you want to be known that you accomplished as a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps? Because I know it must be difficult to have this position and everything that's within your scope and how to address different sergeant majors across the Marine Corps. And now you're in the position to kind of really help those out and shape what the Marine Corps looks like. You as in the Commandant, obviously. But how do you do that? What do you want to be your lasting legacy?
I don't think we write our own legacies. And not because I'm prepared to like answer that question, but it's one of the questions you get a lot when you're kind of doing a job like this. Hey, what do you think your legacy is going to be? I think anybody that writes their own legacy is probably looking for something that's not maybe a reality. That's my opinion. That may not be the case, but I don't focus too much on legacy. I really don't. What are my accomplishments? I think over the course of my career, my focus has been war fighting, period. And I'm not saying that because you expect me to say it now.
Right.
But when I came into the Marine Corps, maneuver warfare was a thing and war fighting was a thing. We were talking about war fighting. The MCDP had just recently come out. It was a thing. I think that's the legacy of the Marine Corps, though. We have a lot of things going on in and around our services. We have a lot of things going on in the Marine Corps. But at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is can we locate, close with, and destroy the enemy? There's another part of that definition in there. I intentionally ignore it. But at the end of the day, if legacy is like a word that's going to be attached to my name, it probably will have to do about taking care of Marines, focusing on what's important, and that's winning. That's winning. I'm not sure that's even a legacy. I think that's what all Marines do. So,
yeah, I think winning is the whole reason why we're here and wanting to do that. Since I got out, there's been a lot of focus on equality in the ranks. How do you feel like we as a Marine Corps have progressed in the last few years of how we view everyone in the uniform, not just the traditional what a Marine looks like in a recruiting poster? How have we been more inclusive and how do we improve on that?
Yeah, great question. I don't think it's a new effort. I think there's more focus on it. An example, and I mentioned maybe a little bit earlier, but I'll rephrase it. When I joined the Marine Corps, Marine Corps recruit training wasn't the same for men and women. Females, as I recall, their recruit training was shorter than the males. 2 years before I came into the Marine Corps, I would have known this as a recruit, women didn't qualify on the rifle range.
Wow.
Yeah, 1986, right, became a requirement. I actually went to DI school in 1994 with a gunnery sergeant who had to go qual on the range before she could become a drill instructor, as I recall, because she joined the Marine Corps before it was a requirement. While I was in recruit training, however, 2 years later, there were female recruits on the range the same time I was. I wouldn't know the difference. Huge change.
Yeah.
Women were still running 1.5 miles for the PFT. I couldn't tell you why I was only 1.5 miles. I guess the fact of the matter was people didn't think women could run 3 miles. I don't know. When I was a drill instructor in 1994, women were running 3 miles by that time. Right, I mentioned to you earlier, women were going to this thing called basic warrior training. Right, there were no women that were getting training in basic warrior stuff like camouflage, cover, concealment, field sanitation, hand arm signals, fire team formations, before General Gray put basic warrior training into recruit training. interesting that that long ago, right, a commandant in the leadership of the Marine Corps understood that women, right, can serve and do these things.
Can you imagine what the Facebook comments would be like?
Oh my gosh, could you imagine?
If you'd have did that then.
Yeah, could you imagine?
It would be
we're all gonna fail miserably.
Right.
I'm married to a Marine. My wife is an amazing Marine. She was a triathlete when she was in the Marine Corps. She was a drill instructor. She was in the band. She's been to combat as a first sergeant. She's a mother. All these opportunities, you know, that we're talking about just the gender differences for a moment, but really it's about opportunity. I'm going to steal a quote from my wife, and I paraphrase it. She says it better than I do, but she goes, you know, people start talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, and equality. Her point is, put that aside for a second. It's about opportunity, right? And I'll reverse it as though she's talking in first person. Don't ever deny me an opportunity, because you can't tell me whether I can do it or not. But you should better give me the damn opportunity. Then it's up to me to prove whether I can.
And women all across right? the Marine Corps are doing that. I mean, they're brand new first sergeant that's involved with, I believe it was the first women first sergeant that is now in charge of a infantry platoon or company. Is that right?
Yeah, she's a sergeant major now. She's okay. Now not in that battalion. She's actually down at Quantico now. But yeah, she was weapons company first sergeant on the last deployment on the MU.
That's awesome.
Right? We have an infantry battalion sergeant major right now who's a female. Over 850 Marines. In 2018, there were about 850 women who were serving in the ground combat element. That's doubled in 4 years. I'm sure it'll double or quadruple over you pick the amount of time. But again, it's about opportunity, right? Once given the opportunity, then it's upon those individuals, right, to compete and to create their own equality. Equity is a different conversation, but their own equality. A year ago, we were at 29 Palms. Running Range 400 with a company that was out there, a battalion. And, you know, for those that are familiar with Range 400, we were up on the rock pile. We were getting ready to leave the rock pile as an observer, head over to the tabletop, different objectives. And off to my right, I hear a female voice, because it wasn't like, hey, hurry up. It was like, hey, hurry up. Mm-hmm. And this female infantry squad leader was running her squad and clearing trenches and doing something that I've seen done hundreds of times, right? And I didn't think to myself for a moment about, well, that's a female, mm-hmm. right? What I thought about is, it's a pretty locked on squad. And because I know the scheme of maneuver so well, I know exactly what they're supposed to do, right? They come out of the wadi, they pop up across the macro terrain, they hit objective. You know what the scheme of maneuver is. And then it dawned on me, it's a female squad leader in an infantry battalion, leading Marines, been doing a phenomenal job of it. She was given the opportunity. And for those familiar with Range 400, that's no easy task for all the way down to the squad level, right? What are we talking about? When forget all the other diversity and equity and inclusive categories you get into. Is it about this or is it about this? If it's about this, which I think it is, then we're Marines.
Right.
Once you're a Marine, you're a Marine. Opportunity aside, don't deny anybody opportunity.
And I think back, that's a great point. And I remember from when I first started in 2004, I was still talking to different leadership, different staff NCOs, gunnery sergeants. Obviously, some sergeants major had the combat experience, but really first sergeants and down didn't have that intensive combat experience where they could train as we fight and be ready to go in that kind of scenario, house-to-house type of situation like we went through in Fallujah. I think one of my biggest mistakes while I was in was focusing on adjectives before Marine, like a combat veteran, highly decorated Marine, things like that. As we move forward and move out of the global war on terrorism phase that's not as strong as it had been, how do you, as a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, keep everybody focused on just being a Marine, doing your job, and not trying to be having high decorations and things like that.
Right. That's an easy one. We're in the middle of a bunch of conflict and combat right now. I think we get enamored sometimes, right, with our experience. And by the way, experience is hugely important. But I asked this question a couple weeks ago, and I posed it just from my experience. I went to combat as a Lance Corporal. I was promoted to corporal on the way back from Desert Storm. I didn't see combat again until I was a gunnery sergeant, a company gunny in an infantry battalion in 2004.
Those roles are wildly different.
Right. The point being is, I'm pretty certain the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, with all of us, the vast majority in that battalion, like across the Marine Corps or any of the services who had less than a year of combat experience under our belt, right, did pretty good. Remember, the push to Baghdad occurred with a bunch of folks that maybe who went to Haiti, might have been in Somalia, if they were staff sergeants or gunnies, maybe majors, but definitely the battalion commanders who had Desert Storm experience. That's a whole decade of not going to combat. Did extremely well. So how, right? Doctrine, training, education. There's a reason we go to 29 Palm. There's a reason why we have a MU workup cycle in the Surdex. There's a reason why you go on UDP and you go to the Northern Training Area to get jungle warfare training. Training and doctrine prepare us. And we spent a whole decade not focusing on combat experience because we didn't have it, and focusing on how to step off on day one and win. I would argue lessons are learned constantly. That was pretty successful. So relying on that training education, you talked about some of the force design stuff a moment ago. Part of our modernization right now is training education, modernizing how we train and educate. That all makes us good on day one. We got to think right now, officially combat operations ended in Afghanistan in 2014, right? The vast majority of staff sergeants and below don't have combat experience. Yet if the balloon went up today, no matter their MOS, whether it's infantry or it's aviation maintenance, right? Their experience, how they've been trained and educated, right, is going to make them successful on day one without years of the same deployment, going to the same place and getting, which is very valuable experience in combat. But you don't start off day one that way.
Right.
Right. I think we're good.
And sitting in the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps' house, that gave me chills. Like, yeah. I wish my jacket wasn't on. And I think the education point is so important. There's a study that just came out by the VA where they had identified breaks in the normal system of, or not system, but the normal statistics of veteran suicide and active duty member suicide. And one of the surprising results to me as I was going through it was that if you have 2 years of college education, your likelihood of committing suicide drops by 50%. When the Marine Corps sees that kind of information come out, do you envision the Marine Corps in this more of a downtime where we can train, putting more education on the civilian side through college and really encouraging Marines to do that?
Yeah, it's great point. I've seen similar studies that kind of highlight this importance of education, right? I guess I would ask the question is, why does that education have such an impact, right? There's a sense of purpose, right? If I have this additional education, my purpose and my worth to either myself, my family, my society, my nation, it increases. It gives me more personal worth. That's a reason to stick around longer, right? Because you mentioned suicide. It's interesting. Combine that with spirituality, right? There's a couple of pretty good studies out right now that say if someone is faith-based, it's like in the 60th percentile, less propensity to have mental health or suicidal behaviors. If they practice that with a faith-based group, it's like 85%, right? People who live healthy lifestyles, whether it's physical fitness or not, right, have a tendency to have greater self-worth that competes against, right? Because it's averse to substance abuse. It's averse to domestic violence. It's averse to those bad behaviors that start to impact someone's mental resiliency and perseverance, right? This is a holistic human performance sort of discussion, right? What makes you you?
For a long time, and that was going to be my follow-up question, for a long time, my identity was wrapped up in this institution. It was wrapped up in being a Marine. And that's what was very difficult for me getting out, where everything about myself that I view positively, and not just people, not just myself, but the people around me, respected because of the type of Marine that I am and was. So I think it's very difficult to transition out of that without finding another identity. And one of the main ways that we're doing that now is through the VA. And to me, I think the biggest difference maker would be having Marines, and no matter what service branch you're in, signing up for the VA automatically in TIMS and TAPS. Because with all due respect, you have never gotten out. And high-level leaders have never gotten out of the Marine Corps. And so a lot of times you're getting advice, you're getting counsel, you're getting wisdom from people who haven't gone through that and don't know what that process is like. How do we make the transition from being on active duty to retiring smoother, and when we're helping our Marines find another identity after the uniform?
Yeah, I think it's a great point, right? Our connectedness, we all have something in common. Whether you are an administrator or whether you are an infantryman, it doesn't matter. You're a Marine. And you mentioned this hyphenated sort of Marine like Corps that you realize or remember. That's like still very offensive to me. I'm not a cyber Marine. I'm not an infantry Marine. I'm a Marine.
Right.
I do cyber. I'm a Marine. I'm in the infantry. I'm a Marine. I do aviation maintenance. Right. I'm a Marine. That commonality, that bond, right, can translate outside of the uniform. You mentioned it. I think we often forget why things like I'm gonna name a few, but it's not to promote them. The VFW exists. Mm-hmm. The Marine Corps League exists. Those groups. You've been to the VFW before.
Oh yeah, that's why I'm here. Here this week to help lobby.
Might be a little trash talking, you know, when you get your $1 beer about what you did in the Marine Corps, the Army.
Right.
There's a little bit of, you know, you're in the Army, you're not as good as being in the Navy.
I will say there is a very distinct difference. I've noticed in this job, I've been doing this job for 7 years, talked to all kinds of people. The biggest difference is other branches of service, no matter which one it is, they will say I was in the military. There is not a single Marine that I've ever heard say I was in the military. Everyone says I'm a Marine.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that's the hallmark of why we're great, because we want that. That title means so much more to us than just, this is not a military job. You're a Marine.
Right. And so when you're out of the uniform, right, and you're in a veteran service organization, I'll use the generic term, a VSO, and you can connect with people like that, you can't get a high and tight and throw on your dress blues anymore. But you're still connected with people who you're like-minded. That's my grandfather was a World War II veteran. He was a member of every organization he could, because those are the people who understood him. They served together. They served in World War II together, right? There was a connectedness there that you might miss when you're on the outside. You wouldn't know. My wife's retired. She's still connected a little bit through me still being in.
So.
Right? But most of her friends... Most of her friends are people who served, not those who are serving, because they have a connectedness there, right? Women Marines Association, she's a member of. Okay. That's a very, not niche group, but it's a very select group of individual women who served in the Marine Corps. They have a connectivity. That prevents them from some of their maybe mental health challenges as well, or their disconnection, right? There's a little bit of unity there. And I think it's very powerful.
And I think the lifelong Marine exists so much more in our branch than in other branches, to be certain. And I love that fact that that's who we are and it's who we will always be. Just like I said, sitting here in the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, my voice shook at the beginning, a little bit nervous for the first time in years. And I remember, I'll tell a story real quick. So I remember being at Quantico and taking my wife's uncle, it was on Iwo Jima. He was in the company that John Bassalon led.
Oh, wow.
And he and the guy that was in the fighting hole with him on Iwo Jima, both of them are still alive, and both of them came up to Quantico to visit the Marine Corps Museum. I took them to the Marine Corps Museum. These gentlemen are about 5'8", 5'9". Both are well into their 80s, and they're staring at the wall that has Eagle Globe and anchors and the Corpsman symbol right across the wall, where you could see every single person that was killed in that battle. We go back to where my office was, and Roy and Jack, both of the guys were in World War II, stood at parade rest while I was talking to them when I was a staff NCO. And I told them, please do not do this. And he looked at me and he said, it's important that I do this because I am a corporal and you are a staff sergeant. Hmm. And I just think no other branch has that.
You know, there's a quote documents because they're evidence. People can't, you can get social media to death unless you speak the fact, right? There's a document that came out. It's a joint publication. It's called the NCO and Petty Officer, backbone of the U.S. Armed Forces. It came out 2013. And the premise behind this document is a lot of the times when we're training our allies and our partners, right, in these theaters career cooperation events, you know, it's hard to explain to them what the U.S. military services do. So this document was produced, and it was really produced in order to talk about what the non-commissioned officer and petty officer do. And just for clarity, when we speak NCO in the Marine Corps, we're talking about corporal and sergeant. For the rest of the services, it's like...
Yeah, forever.
It's like, yeah, it's like corporal to E9.
When
right?
I Whatever went to a joint service school, and they kept calling me sergeant, and I was like, I'm going to flip out.
Yeah, right?
If you keep doing it, I'm going to flip the f*** out.
That's right. But perspective, right? And so... In this book, the Space Force wasn't a service yet, but it is a description of the services. And a description of the Army, land battle, right? The nation's army, armor. It's big on, you know, that sort of perspective, right? And then the Navy, sea dominance, part of nuclear triad, submarines. It's about ships, right? The carrier in particular, right? Air Force, also part of the nuclear triad, airplanes, right? Air dominance. And then what's interesting is there's the Marines, the description of the Marines. And I'm not shitting it. It starts off with the Marines are different, right? It starts off with honor, courage, commitment, war fighting. It's about the Marine, their weapon, and the team that they're a member of. We fight to maintain our culture. We fight to maintain our war fighting ethos. We determine to be different. And it kind of ends with, and we'll kick your ass, kind of like the end of it, right? In so many words. But it's such a different description of having a joint publication produced by the chairman's staff with all this great description of all the services, and to see the Marine Corps, like, make it through publishing and editing, start off with, the Marines are different. I'm biased. I'm a sergeant major of the Marine Corps. Marines are different. We are different. We are different.
Right. And yeah. You see that in... Even in what's going on in Ukraine with Russia, you see that. And you see, even though we don't have grunts on the ground, we do have the Marine Corps logistics that are helping. And I think that that's the major difference right now. One of the major differences between us and everybody else in the world is our logistic chain. I would have never said that when I was in. I would have never thought of it. I'd been like, these guys are pogues. They're not doing anything. And you see when you get out, at least I did, the value of every single job, and nothing exists in a vacuum. Nothing.
Yeah, it's that's a great point. I left 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines in 2011 after a great deployment to Afghanistan. And because I had to leave, I'm a sergeant major, I kind of had an idea about what I wanted to do for orders because you have a little bit of leverage when you're a sergeant major. I asked to go to a combat logistics battalion. I went to COB5 after leaving 3-7. So you might talk about like infantry guy, infantry battalion, sergeant major. I'm in my environment. I went to a combat logistics battalion and it was like fish out of water.
I want to explain something to our civilian listeners about that. So there's two different sides of the Marine Corps whenever you get to E8. It's either master sergeant or it's first sergeant. A master sergeant, you stay in your MOS. A first sergeant, you could be anywhere. And it's the same thing for master gunnery sergeant and sergeant major. So whenever you get to that position, you kind of have to decide which way you're going to go. And it was always impressive to me in a combat scenario. The first sergeant that I had, it was a reconnaissance first sergeant. And he had come from, I believe, the MP field and came over there as the first sergeant. And he said, I don't have the experience, but I have the gumption and I have the desire to learn every single thing that I need to. Sitting here talking to you for the past however long it's been, you clearly have a lot of knowledge about a lot of different areas. In my line of work, people will ask me, what do you think about Russia? How do you think that this is going to go? And I tell them, I don't know, man. Like, I got it as a staff NCO. I have zero idea about inner politics. How have you gained that knowledge reading? What is your way that you have learned so much? Is it just time, or are you intensive in your study? Probably both.
I'd say a combination of both. I think you have to be. If you're determined to have a long career in the Marine Corps, any service, any career, you may have a long career in the business you're in right now.
Hope so.
You can't do that unless you start to become a professional at it. You've got to study. You have to research. You have to not know what has happened, which is a pretty good indication, right? History is a pretty good indicator of what's going to happen, especially for military terms. But be innovative and be forward thinking as well, right? You can't do that unless you educate yourself, be educated, and gain a heck of a lot of experience. And so for me personally, if my wife were here right now, she would tell you I have memorized almost every word of every military history channel show that's ever been on, right? Because I have a personal interest in that. But interestingly enough, I'm talking about in terms of the military, you got to think beyond the military power, right? What are the real elements of national power? It's called DIME, right? Diplomacy, information, intelligence. We kind of argue about what that really means now. Military, economic. And there's a couple other things that have been added on to that over time. But really, those are the four big elements, right? As an example of my learning. I would think being a Marine, military, the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. You can kick your butt, therefore we will win. But what's the most influential or most powerful element of national power? Economic. Mm-hmm. Right? A nation's ability to pay for a military, to have diplomatic influence, to be able to understand and manage an information environment where they can have enough information about how to compete and deter aggression globally. That's through economics, right? You wouldn't know that unless you had learned about it. That's very influential in the job that I have right now, because I find myself spending most of my time talking about resources, which are attached to economics, which are attached to budgets, which are attached to how we buy things, train people, educate people, recruit people, retain people. It's all part of an economic sort of background, right? You don't get that unless you determine you're going to professionalize and get outside of being a machine gunner, right? You have to expand that knowledge base. So I think that's got a lot to do with it.
And you said looking forward, and the career roadmap is pretty clear about how to get promoted and how to move up the ranks in the Marine Corps. You've reached the top of the highest that you can go on the enlisted side. When do you start looking for your next step now? Because the next step, I assume it was to get to this point or to be the best sergeant major that you could possibly be. But you're running close to your end of time since you've been in the service. When do you start looking to your next phase of life?
Well, public service announcement, even the sergeant major of the Marine Corps has to go to TRS 12 months before the EAS.
Okay.
All right. So I went to TRS already back in August. So that's
God, a requirement. I'd hate to be that instructor of the right? other students in there.
Well, you just cast it and you be quiet because they're like, oh, sergeant major's here. You can't mess it up. But I went to TRS. I think like all of us, or we should, you got to figure out what your lab's going to be after, right? I won't disclose specifically what the couple of three or four things I'm interested in right now, because you don't want to be presumptive in that. But I think if we don't focus on what's next, the Marine Corps ends for everybody at some point in time, no matter what you might think. Almost 36,
if you love
35
it,
years.
Like yeah. you should, it's hard.
That's right. It's going to end by your choice or by time. So you got to prepare for that future. If I was Lance Corporal Black and I was getting out of the Marine Corps, I wish somebody had told me, save some money, right?
Drink less. A lot of money in Okinawa.
Yeah, just right?
Shit. I mean, drink I was less. One of those had a sword, right?
Right, yeah. Because you'll save money if you do that.
Right.
If you're going to go to the gym, maybe don't lift as much weight as the guy who's been training for like 8 years. You might be injured, right? Think about your family, because they're always going to be with you, right? I'm being kind of sort of reflective a little bit right now, but just for everybody, there's the Marine Corps. There's your friends who are in the Marine Corps, your lifelong attachment to it, and then there's the rest of your life. That comes to everybody at some point in time. I'm definitely preparing for the next chapter, because no matter what happens, that chapter is coming.
It's coming.
I got the benefit. I live with a retired Marine.
I was just going to ask
just a Marine,
that.
By the
right.
way. If she were here right now and I said retired Marine, she'd knock me in my chops, right? But she's a Marine. And so I've seen that process. again, I'll use her as an example. My wife had a she became a cake designer, right, as a hobby while she was in the Marine Corps.
A cake designer?
You know, like you see on TV, these crazy cake shows.
Right.
And yeah, that's she was doing that before.
I heard you, but I thought I definitely misheard you.
Yeah, cake artist. So when she retired, she went to culinary school. She's a pastry chef, and she has her own business.
Wow.
She had a plan before she got out. If you don't have a plan before you get out, you're probably going to struggle. You're probably going to struggle.
Right, and finding that tribe, keeping that tribe is so important whenever you do step out. I think that that was probably my biggest mistake post-Marine Corps is not keeping up with as many people as I possibly could. I think it's very beneficial for you to have a first sergeant wife that you could ask her and see.
She might have a chance to make sure to do the right thing all the time.
Right, yeah. And this house too. I want you to talk a little bit about this house, and you're the first sergeant major of the Marine Corps to live here. Can you kind of explain the history and what it's like living here on a daily basis?
All jokes aside, for a kid from Louisville, Kentucky, who grew up with a single parent, my mom, literally eating government cheese and free powdered milk, right?
So are you used to the eggs whenever you got to boot camp?
Yeah, right. To one, join the Marine Corps and to end up having this opportunity, blessed every single day. You know, being the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps is historic enough in itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, who saw that coming, right? Anybody watching this that knows me over my career is like, hey, you ain't lying. But then
that's not true. That is not true. The mass sergeant that I told you about at the beginning,
yeah,
when we were riding back to she was like, that guy is going to be the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps.
I'm glad you thought so. You should see it, people talk about it on social media about five comments in. but didn't have the opportunity to have the commandant of the Marine Corps say, and now the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps is going to live at Marine Barracks 8th and I, because that's where the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps should be. Interesting. I have a letter hanging on the wall over there. Sergeant Major Massaro had written, put down some points that as he was leaving and being the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, he left some notes for the Commandant. One of them was, and the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps should live at the same place the Commandant does. You got the Commandant of the Marine Corps, you have the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, right? Or the first service, the Marine Corps, have a service senior enlisted. The first.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the Navy followed about 10 years later, Army followed shortly thereafter, Air Force years after that. I mean, almost a decade, there was a Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps before there was an of the Navy, Army, et cetera. And so what better way to honor the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps than living at the oldest post of the Marine Corps, Marine Barracks, Washington? You asked the question, you know, what's that like? It's every day my wife and I both, we're like, there's carts they have outside and you carry your groceries from the garage, which, by the way, used to be a horse stable. Back when, like, this was a Marine barracks, you know, like we had like horses and stuff. And we carry our groceries, you know, out of our garage. We're pulling our groceries, you know, around the sidewalk. And we look to our left, and there's the parade deck that Marines march on every Friday night during the summertime. And you're looking, you look to your right, and there's the Commandant's house. And you look around this row of houses here where the Assistant Commandant lives here. You know, the Marine barracks commanding officer lives here. You know, there's the other side of the parade deck where that was actually where Marines lived, you know, in the 1800s. And then, like, you walk up your front steps and you go, there's a sign on the you know, the stanchion and the pole outside that says, home of the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. And you kind of look at that for a moment and you go, I'd like to meet that person someday. And you're like, holy shit, that's you, man. And it's just like, wow, every single day is like, it's kind of like a dream, to be frank. It really, really is.
Today's show is also brought to you by SimpliSafe. If you're a regular listener, you know I recommend SimpliSafe Home Security, and I'm not the only one. U.S. News recently named SimpliSafe the best home security system of 2023, and CNET recently rewarded their editor's choice for home security. There are many reasons why SimpliSafe is trusted by the experts and customers alike. I use it whenever I go out of town. I was in D.C. this week doing a little bit of lobbying with the VFW, which you know about if you listened to the last show, and I didn't have to worry about it because anytime I could check on my family, make sure they're all good, and I know that everybody's fine at night because the security system is there and monitored all the time. SimpliSafe is designed with cutting-edge technology and backed by 24/7 professional monitoring. In the emergency, agents use fast protect technology only from SimpliSafe to capture critical evidence and verify the threat is real. Real. So you can get a priority police dispatch over there. It's 24/7 professional monitoring service, only costs $1 a day, less than half the price of traditional home security systems. And you can lock and unlock your doors, access your camera, arm and disarm your system from anywhere in the old world. Customize the perfect system for your home in just a few minutes at simplisafe.com/ZBT. Go today and claim a free indoor security system plus 20% off your order with interacting monitoring. That's simplisafe.com/ZBT. There is no safe like SimpliSafe.
I would imagine so. And like you said earlier, going back to Lance Corporal Black, and when you're Sergeant Black, and even probably Gunny Sergeant Major Black, after your career and you're winding down and you're getting close to the end, what would you say your biggest leadership failure was?
Actually, it's not as hard as it sounds. I was in Afghanistan in 2010. And we were 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, great infantry battalion. You talk about the planets aligning. Great commander. Staff NCOs are phenomenal. The company commanders, one of them, the last of our company commanders, I think, just retired here a couple months ago. As a lieutenant colonel. Anyway, long story short, we were doing some operations in a place called the Musa Kalay Wadi. And it's right over the Helmand River from Fob Jackson or Sangin, which is, we went there later on in a deployment. But at the end of the day, we're fighting up this wadi, and the jump platoon commander, who was a sergeant, we hit an IED one day. He got evacuated for some concussion protocols. And then we turned it over to another corporal. So you got a corporal leading three or four corporals and a bunch of lance corporals and a corpsman around with the battalion commander and sergeant major of the battalion all over the battlefield, just whipping it on. Good deployment. We had a combat logistics patrol.
That's such a, like, that's a good
right?
deployment.
Whipping it on. It was good, right?
We're getting shot at every day. We're doing it. That's good. A good deployment. That's a good day. Good. Yeah.
And so we had a CLB that was coming to do a resupply. In fact, historical, we had had a helo resupply a couple of days before because the bad guys had gotten around us and sealed off all the ground lines of communication. We couldn't get a combat logistics patrol in to supplies. So we had a helo resupply of ammunition and water and chow. It was a good couple of weeks in Musa Kalay. Anyway, we had the CLB was coming up to do this resupply, and we had to send out the jump platoon to go pick them up and bring them in through friendly lines. Well, I stayed at the CP. The jump platoon went out to get them about 5 or 6 minutes, maybe 10 minutes after they left. You know, we heard the familiar kind of boom sound of an IED going off. So everybody knew an IED went off. And so we're like, well, what the hell? And so I had a radio on myself. I was in communication with the jump platoon because we were in the fight. Two companies were moving up the wadi, a pretty good fight against several hundred Taliban that were operating in the area. And I radio in, you know, what's going on? And the jump platoon, A-slash, right, the assistant clip jump commander just radioed in, you know, I'm not going to say his name, but hey, so-and-so's down. I'm like, what do you mean so-and-so's down? So I radio, how do you know? And he says he's laying right here in front of us. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? So me and the battalion SJA captain, former infantry guy, by the way, captain, a corpsman and another Marine, you know, picked up our crap, and we ran 300 or 400 meters. This is like middle of August, too, or middle of July. It's freaking hotter than dog's not. Actually, this was June. Yeah, June 22nd. I believe that's the date. Anyway, we're running through the desert. We get over to where the IED strike was at, and Here's to your question, my biggest mistake, I think. What had happened was this Marine who had cleared IEDs in that deployment by this time, halfway through, a couple hundred times, right? There's a certain procedure that you use. You're supposed to take your Valon out, you know, a mine detector. You wave it. When you hear something, you kind of step aside, you set your stuff down, you brush out with your hands, kind of outline the thing, and you call for EOD, you mark and you call for EOD. This one time, he brushed dirt away with his foot and blew him into 1,000 pieces. And the whole time, me and these three Marines are picking up pieces of him for a couple of hours, right? Up until we got to the upper half of him, which was he'd been almost cut in half, completely eviscerated, and picking up pieces of him. All I thought about the whole time was, did we practice how to do this enough? Now, I know during the training, that PTP, we had gone through this immediate action drill, I don't know how many times, hundreds if not thousands of times. And I asked myself, do we cut it short one day? Should we have done it one more time? Maybe if we had done it one more time.
Right? How did you balance, or have you balanced that it wasn't your fault? And how did you come to terms that I got to keep going?
Not sure it wasn't. Maybe we should have done that one more time. Maybe it was his fault for being complacent, right? Maybe it was hot outside and he's been clearing these things 1,000 times. It's just another beep with the mine detector, right? Mm-hmm. But even with that, why that one time he decided to use his foot rather than do what he was supposed to do after I had seen him do it 100,000 times? Why? Right? So maybe it was. So now you're talking about living with guilt, mm-hmm. right? The fact of the matter is you don't know. But you asked what my biggest failure was? Probably not doing that one more time.
And how did that impact the way that you led after?
Well, after all the nicknames I had during that deployment in particular, you know, the Dominator, the Intimidator, the Black Death, the Black Plague, you know, kind of all those things. Because whenever I would get around, and I probably still do, it's much harder being the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps and look around and see everything that's wrong. Because you got to tell everybody a thing. You kind of keep them riled up a little bit. But to not miss anything, I think I have a higher sense. Even after having been a drill instructor twice, I think my sense of looking for everything to make sure that everything's exactly right and attention to detail now is probably greater than it was then. Because if I had been sitting in the vehicle behind and saw him get ready to do that with his foot, I would have jumped out. I would have gotten the radio. I would have thought, that's wrong, you shouldn't do that, and try to make that correction immediately, right? Maybe a little heightened sense of that, right? Because I'm convinced if we had done that one more time, maybe that wouldn't have happened. Maybe.
That's a tough position to be in and then continue and know for the rest of that deployment, you got to lead. You don't have the opportunity to sit down and really get your thoughts and gather your thoughts. Was there ever a time, for instance, myself, whenever I got injured and got out, I put everything down, like all those feelings and emotions, and I wanted to leave my Marines. How did you deal with that?
I'm a bit of an introvert in some things. Well, I'll be honest with you. The guy that was on the radio that said, I see him, I'm staring at him, and stared at his upper part of his torso for 2 hours till we could get up there and put him in a bag. He and I developed an instant relationship. He was only a corporal then. And I was the battalion sergeant major. He did one more deployment with 3-7 and got out. And we've maintained a relationship ever since. I think we kind of lean on each other a little bit. I'll get a random text from him every once in a while, even today. He's very successful. He's in his late 30s, early 40s now. He's married. They're going to have a child. I can tell him he's having a bad day. He'll just randomly just hit me up. And I'll respond, and sometimes I just write him out of a clear blue sky. So you gotta be able to have an attachment with somebody if you're going through whatever your challenge is. That one's pretty niche if you think about it. A lot of us may have the same experiences, but I rely on him a good deal.
Yeah, and there's a lot of my friends that were there as well that I lean on, and because I think, like for me, for example, when I got shot, you go through kind of like you did I make a tactical mistake? What was the error that I make? And that ate me up for a long time. Like, I'm supposed to be the best dog handler around and I made this mistake. Why did I do it? And coming to grips with that was hard. And I didn't have to lead as long as you do after that. But I'm sure that it makes you, I'm rambling here. I'm going to get there. One of my Marines, after it happened, he ended up getting hit by an IED. He had ball bearings and things like that all the way through his legs. Before, I had had different Marines that were injured and it was very hard to deal with. After I got injured, it was like a whole different level and it changed my perspective. And I think the first time I saw somebody die in combat, I didn't know really how to deal with that. And I kind of pushed it down, like introverted as well. Do you feel that the Marine Corps, after every deployment, should have a better focus on therapy and counseling after somebody experiences like what you did?
That's a tough question. Let me tell you why it's a tough question. That would assume that not enough is being done now, right? I think that would be a bad assumption because there's more available now than there ever has been. So I think we've learned a lot over time. I'm not kind of giving like what the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps should say as a response to you. I know it was like coming back from Desert Storm, right? There was a leave period and that was it, right? But all those leaders were Vietnam veterans. They had nothing, right? I know living with the World War II veteran and my grandfather, there wasn't anything for those guys. Right? If you served in the military, you know, there's an experience. The experience is lifelong, right? Movie 300. You seen 300?
Yes.
A dad freaks out when his kid gets killed. I'm sure that's timeless, right? And so how we appreciate that over time, I think we're in a good place. We're probably not as good as we could be because we will always try to get better in how we deal with post-deployment or post-combat operational stress or post-traumatic stress. Whatever the term du jour is going to be, right? Because the mind's a real thing. And you have to be able to deal with that. You talked about getting shot. You talked about IEDs. Heck, that same deployment, either on the ground, definitely inside vehicles. I mean, our jump section hit IEDs 5 times, the vehicle I was in. Right? You're talking about a reality check.
Right.
Right. Like getting shot, you're kind of like, oh, I'm still alive. And you're bleeding. It hurts. It's like really painful. But you're like, wow, I did that. Right. So when you get blown up, you're like, wow.
I never talk about that part when I was sitting under the stairwell, this is pretty cool. Like,
yeah, it's not like the coolest thing in the world, but you're like, holy shit, I made it.
Yeah.
I'm alive. I think everybody's experience is probably unique, right? But that's kind of like the challenge. Everybody's experience is different. I think as we learn to deal more with the human piece, right? I mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, spirituality, mental. If you were an aircraft, if you were a human being and you were a Marine and you were an aircraft, we have this checklist, right, of non-negotiable things you would have to do in order to fly, right? You got to update data systems, you got to have fuel, you got to test the fuel, air in the tires, wings work, figuring that, everything. It's a checklist. Maintainers run around there inspecting everything. You got CDIs, CDQARs, you got pilots going through and checking stuff, you got maintenance chiefs. Like, that aircraft does not take off unless all these mandatory sort of performance things are enforced. And every time an airplane doesn't perform so well in the air, you can trace it back to not doing one of those things. We don't do any of that as a requirement for humans or Marines. There's a lot of resources that are available, right? Are you required to be invested in those resources? No, because as humans, we have this freedom of choice. I'm an alcoholic, but I don't need to go to the SACO.
Right.
Right, we think, well, there's a stigma attached to it if you go to the psycho. Okay, if you're an alcoholic, there's gonna be a hell of a stigma if you run over somebody and tell them you're drunk and driving. Yeah. Right? There's a stigma for you. But at the end of the day, how do we think holistically about humans, right? Mental, physical, spiritual, social, and behavioral. I call them fitness, call them performance standards, call them psychology, call them whatever. If I say human performance to you, the first thing you think about is like a PFT and CFT. Okay, but that's the end result of how's your brain doing? How's your behavior? How's your social interaction, right? What is your sense of spirituality, right? How is your mental fitness? If those were non-negotiables, we probably, to get to your point, how do you think we're doing? We're probably in a different place. We're probably in a different place about how we think about the human capital, that Marine. After those incidents, before those incidents, during those incidents, life in general. Because ultimately what we're trying to make is the best warrior, right?
Yes.
There you go.
And my last question for you, Sergeant Major, it's a little bit of a relaxed setting, probably a little more relaxed interview than you do usually. Your message for Marines. If you had the entirety of the Marine Corps that was sitting here and you had a relaxed setting, what would you tell them?
Keep the main thing the main thing. These are two quick stories, right? One, had a recruiter, my recruiter, and of course he was giving us great advice. He says, here's how you're successful in the Marine Corps. He was past recruit training, right? He was past boot camp. Here's how you're successful in the Marine Corps. He says, when you get up in the morning, do everything the best you can, as fast as you can until chow. I'm like, okay, what happens to that? He goes, do everything you can, as fast as you can, the best you can, until chow. I kind of see where this is going, right?
Right.
He says, and after that, do everything you can, the best you can, as fast as you can, until chow.
Does he make you go to midrats, though?
Well, I didn't know what that was at the time, right? And then he says, and then after evening chow, do everything you can, the best you can, until you get the next day and you go to chow. I have kept that with me ever since. And it seems like such a thing you would tell someone going to boot camp. But think about anybody who's a professional at anything, and they drive and strive to be the best. Whether they ever are the best or not is not the point, right? It's what effort do they put in to get as far as they can in that hierarchy, right? Of whatever level of success you deem, do you get up every day and do everything you can, the best you can, in order to be the best at whatever that thing is? I got that from a recruiter 35 plus years ago. And the other thing is understanding what your responsibilities are. I got promoted to corporal, like I mentioned, on the way back from Desert Storm. And I was on an LST. We had such things back then. Landing ship tank or whatever. I don't know. We don't have them anymore. It was an amphib ship. And there were like 500, 600.
You got rid of the vehicle and the Marine Corps didn't crumble?
Oh, don't go there. Right. It's a whole different discussion, right? But I get promoted to corporal, and there's like a whole bunch of NCOs on the ship at the time. I get promoted to corporal 1 April of 1991, right? And there's a working party going. And for those of us who have been on ship before, you're doing the unwrap, right? You're on an LST. The LST is like about the size of the parade deck guy here at 8th and I. And they run all the supplies back and forth from the supply ship on ropes, right? There's no helicopters bringing stuff in. It's just ropes. So we've got Marines on working parties. We get a pallet. It comes across on a rope. You put the pallet down. You unload it, and there's the chain gang all the way down to someplace in the ship, and you just pass the pallets along, and they go down to the hold of the ship. Well, I got promoted to corporal on 1 April, and there was underway replenishment like within a couple of days after that. And the company gunnery sergeant, Gunny Miller, came up to me and said, hey, Corporal Black, you're in charge of this working party. I'm like, all right, Corporal Black's in charge. My first job is an NCO. So we're doing this underway replenishment, and I'm in the chain gang, and I'm moving boxes, right? I'm moving boxes. And Gunnery Sergeant Miller comes up, hey, Black, come here. So I ran over to him and said, yes, Gunny. He goes, hey, first of all, I told you that you were in charge of this working party over here. I'm like, yes. And he goes, okay, so Corporal Black, go over and be in charge of the working party. I'm like, okay. Like, I'm putting a little bit of that tax thing I told you about. I'm like,
right.
Your problem. Right? So I didn't say that to him because he would crush me. But I ran back over and I got right back in the chain gang again. And I'm moving stuff. I'm moving stuff. I'm moving stuff. I'm moving stuff. A little while later, I hear, Black, get your ass over here. So I run back over there again. He goes, what did I tell you? He says, if you want to be Lance Corporal Black, then you can get back in the working party. But you're Corporal Black now. You're in charge of the working party. I then realized that every time he would call me over to reprimand me, he was just saying my last name. And before I left, he was saying, now Corporal Black, go back over there and be in charge of the working party. It took me a while to figure that. It wasn't until years later I picked up on what he was saying.
Took me when you said it.
Yeah, right? I got it at the time because what he was saying is you need to take a step back. You need to make sure the most efficient working party is being conducted. They're moving stuff as fast as they can. Keep them hydrated because it was hotter than crap. We were coming back in the middle of summertime across the Pacific. Be in charge. Unfortunately, you just lost the responsibility being in charge of the working party of being there with your buddies, dipping Copenhagen, talking trash, and moving boxes back and forth. You're now a non-commissioned officer. Now, later on, there was a sergeant in charge of my happy and I was moving boxes.
Right.
But the lesson he was teaching me is you need to know your responsibility, right? So be the best you can, know your responsibilities. And I think in any occupation, definitely as a Marine, if you figure those two things out, you'll achieve whatever relative amount of success you're doomed to achieve. Those two simple lessons early in my career, both of them my first 4 years in the Marine Corps, have served me at least relatively well.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Sergeant Major.
Appreciate you. Thanks.